This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team, Jim Poplava and John Loeffler.
Earlier today, my colleagues and I on the Federal Open Market Committee discussed overall economic conditions and decided to keep the target range for the federal funds rate at 0.25% to 0.5%. We judged that the case for an increase has strengthened, but decided for the time being to wait for further evidence of continued progress toward our objectives. Our current policy should help move the economy toward our statutory goals of maximum employment and price stability.
That was the well-known voice of Federal Reserve Chair Janet Yellen, who said they were not going to raise interest rates at this time, delaying raising interest rates. She did hint that we might do it in December, but, does anybody really believe she's going to do that in an economy which is in rapid deceleration mode? And you realize she has delayed raising interest rates six times this year. So when she says she's going to do that, it's sort of, okay, yeah, right, whatever, until the next time it seems like they might do that. What does all of this mean, Jim? That's the big picture today. Welcome to the big picture, everybody.
Well, I mean, there's a number of things right here. I mean, a couple of weeks ago, we had one Fed governor make a comment that they're going to have to raise rates because the economy was in danger of overheating. We discussed on the program that's probably more to keep the markets in check. But, John, we're seeing more and more evidence that the economy is slowing down. So I can't imagine, with all of the uncertainty now over the political election that's coming up here in about less than 45 days, we also have the economic numbers, and we also have this diverging monetary policy. So if the Fed raises interest rates and makes rates here even more attractive to foreign buyers, which could also raise the value of the dollar against other currencies, and that's a risk for corporate profits. And that's one of the things that we'll be noticing or getting some news on shortly here when companies report third quarter profits. Because remember, forecasts are usually a continuation of the previous trends. And no surprise, every single year, it happens every year, analysts project that corporate profits will increase 10 to 12% for the year ahead. Then all of a sudden we get into quarter one, quarter two, and all of a sudden those estimates start to come down, and they really start to come down by third quarter. It's the same thing with economic forecast. We were supposed to grow at almost 2.5% this year. And then, of course, that got changed in the first quarter by the Fed. They changed it again in the second quarter because in the first quarter we had 0.8%. The economy's only growing at 1%. So it's really questionable that they would raise in December. And the only reason they would raise is if we, for example, got an overheated stock market and credit spreads continue to narrow between high quality and low quality bonds. That might be a reason for it to happen. But outside of that, I even question whether December is a reality.
Well, if you look at it, Jim, let's zoom this back a bit so we understand the framework here. What we seem to have been doing for the last decade and a half, that's about 16 years, actually earlier than that, let's just make it 2 decades. Yeah, 16 years is good. We went from the tech bubble bursting, which happened right about the time of the turn of the century. 9-1-1 was immediately after that. We had Hurricanes Katrina and Rita. There was the oil crisis, which very few people saw coming. The financial crisis that put us into this recession, 2007-2008, and its recovery, not to mention the Arab winter, as I'm calling it. It was originally called an Arab spring, but I don't buy that. So what we've done is we've lurched from one crisis to the next over these last 16 years, and all of this tends to buffet the money situation and also the markets, and we have to deal with this as investors.
Well, it's not just that we have to deal with it as investors. Policymakers have to deal with this in terms of trying to predict what they need to do. And it's kind of flummoxed both economists in the private sector and also the Fed. I mean, the forecast that the Fed has made has been wrong over 90% of the time, and they change it every single year. How many times have we heard over the last 7 years that they were going to do one thing and they end up doing something next? Because we're really dealing in a global economy where the old rules aren't working. You know, it's been called by the folks at PIMCO the new normal. But the problem is we're operating in a different economic paradigm, and what used to work doesn't work. And the best example I can give you is quantitative easing and negative interest rates has failed to bring about sustainable economic growth and liftoff, which is why, as we'll get further into this, is why we think that you're going to see fiscal stimulus or helicopter drops coming next, whether it starts in Japan or it starts in Europe. But it's definitely coming here because, as we've seen in this presidential campaign, both candidates are talking about spending money. Forget the idea about balancing a budget. That's gone out the window. That went out last November when they busted the sequester in the budget deal, because the deficit this year is going to be $200 billion more than it was the previous year. So unconventional markets, when we see what's going on in the market today, a lot of people are puzzled. A lot of people, especially individual investors, have stayed on the sidelines these last 7 years because they haven't seen the robust economic growth as in previous recoveries. And beginning going back to the summer of 2014, we've seen declining corporate earnings. So what is driving stock prices higher, bond yields lower? It is the economy and the markets are running on money flows. And those money flows are determining asset prices.
And I think what's significant here, Jim, is that if we look at it, if it's done anything, the quantitative easing, instead of inflating things in the economy, has actually inflated assets instead. So it's almost like your theory of when money is created, it has to run somewhere. Well, inflation has to go somewhere, and it did in assets.
Yeah, and that's the problem. When money's created, a lot of the money that the Fed created, everybody's talked about the Fed's balance sheet being over $4 trillion. Same thing with the ECB. The problem is when the Fed creates money, a lot of that money remained on the Fed's balance sheet. It's only when a bank takes that money and creates credit, or you get credit expansion, do you get economic activity and inflation. That's why a lot of the hyperinflation forecasts have gone awry, because we just haven't seen it. If the money is sitting on the Fed's balance sheet, because the Fed now pays banks interest, it's a nice safe place for banks to be and park money and not worry about taking on risk. That's number one. And number two, you've had increasing regulations, especially coming in with Dodd-Frank, that has limited the ability of banks to make loans and also cut back on the liquidity in the marketplace. So there's been a number of side effects, and that's another reason, besides debt, that we have not seen this economic expansion operate in a normal way. Typically, after a recession, you'd see economic growth in the first couple of years of 4%, 5%, and 6%, and it would average 3%. We've been averaging 2% or less, and now some are saying 1% is probably going to be a new normal if we don't head into a recession. So despite the low record interest rates, some 8 years after the crisis, John, still investors are petrified of risk. And it's amazing, because let's talk about this for a minute. When the Fed goes in, or the ECB or the Bank of Japan, and they buy government bonds or corporate bonds, so you're a bank, you're sitting on government bonds, or you're an institution, you're sitting on government bonds, the Fed comes in, buys those bonds from you, now you have that cash. Where are you going to put the cash? Well, most likely you're going to put it to work in the markets. And that's what's fueling the markets. The markets are going up because investors in a low interest rate environment are willing to pay more for a dollar in dividends or earnings than they did in the past. So the Fed's money flow, when they're buying those bonds, they're creating liquidity in the outlet. If you're a company and your bonds are bought, what are you going to do? Are you going to build a new plant or a new factory with the economy growing at an anemic rate? No. So what are you doing? You're buying back stock, you're increasing dividends, or you're putting the money to work in mergers, or if you're institutions, you're buying stock. So that's why we are seeing inflation, but the inflation isn't really occurring in the economy because credit isn't flowing in its normal sense. We're still below trends in credit creation and lending because there's too much debt out there. So what you're seeing is, if you look at the flow of funds, it's being driven into asset markets. But what I find interesting is, despite the lowest interest rates that we've seen in recorded history, instead of the search for yield, the search for safety has trumped the search for yield, meaning investors are looking everywhere they can to find safe investments.
So does that account for why the price, for example, of government bonds is bidding up to historically low yields, or why at least institutional investors right now are willing to put their money into them at negative interest rates?
Well, it is. You take a look at where the money is flowing, and especially this year, there's a scramble for safety. And that's what's creating some of the lowest yields that we're seeing now, both in sovereign markets. And despite what you've seen this year, basically, John, some of the best returns have been in sovereigns. If you buy a bond that has a negative interest rate of, let's say, 5 basis points, and then let's say interest rates go to a negative 20 basis points or 25, as we're seeing in Switzerland, you can actually make capital gains in the bond that you own. And some of the best returns this year have been in some of the lowest assets that have produced the best returns. So despite low yields on safe assets, investors are reaching for duration rather than risk.
Okay, hold up there for a second. Explain what you're talking about here.
Duration is basically the overall maturity value of a bond portfolio. So what I mean by they're reaching for duration, they are extending and buying bonds with longer maturities. And the reason is those are the bonds that really appreciate the most when interest rates go down. So let's say you had, at the beginning of the year, you were sitting on a 20-year treasury bond yielding 2.25%, and rates got down to 1.4%. John, that is a huge double-digit capital gain. So investors have been accumulating large position holdings in these safe securities because of the rate of return. It's just like my friend Gary Schilling. One of the reasons he owns zero coupon bonds and treasuries, long-dated ones, is not necessarily for the yield, but for the capital appreciation. And in some of those treasuries, if you bought a 2.25%, let's say, treasury bond, you have almost double-digit gains. And then that's been one of the best performing asset classes this year, because one of the problems is central banks have been buying a hoard of securities, their own government bonds, and they're really walking a tightrope right now to fend off potential power keg over lower interest rates and growing duration risk. In other words, as investors go out and buy longer-term bonds, let's say you bought a bond at 1.4%, or you bought, a negative Japanese bond at a negative 15 or 20 basis points, and now Japanese bonds have gone up. They're almost reaching towards positive territory. You know, you have greater risk the longer maturity those bonds are. Just as you have greater capital gain appreciation, you also have the greater potential for economic loss. We'll talk about that here in a minute when we talk about a best defense. But central banks are really working through uncharted territory. And quite honestly, I don't think anybody has a clear handle how this all ends up.
So what's happening here, if I'm listening to you correctly, is that the low interest rates are forcing investors to take more risks.
Well, absolutely. I mean, it's likely, though, and it's not undisputed, that this search for yield in this low interest rate environment can contribute to a buildup of financial imbalances, because this risk-taking channel, which is we're seeing being created by monetary policy, could be particularly relevant when everybody is saying, gosh, low economic growth, low numbers. Everybody is making bets based on a low interest rate environment will persist, and that monetary policy will be eased in the case of any kind of market turmoil, as we saw with Brexit, with the Bank of England creating 250 billion euros. So it's what's been referred to as the central bank put. So it adds an additional element of risk because everybody is making bets, and it gets back to what Hyman Minsky has talked about, is financial instability is created by long periods of stability. When everybody thinks a economic paradigm or market paradigm will remain in place for a long time, it encourages them to go out and take more risk. And we're seeing that right now with investors going out and taking duration risk, buying bonds with longer term maturities, with the idea and concept that interest rates will only stay low and remain low for an extended period of time. And there's various reasons why interest rates could rise. We'll talk about that here shortly.
Yeah, but this all comes down to a really important question, because I think a lot of the role of the Federal Reserve is to maintain expectations. And, you know, this creates a problem in the minds of investors or institutions. How many times can the Fed say they're going to raise interest rates? Well, we're not going to do it now, but just you wait. We're going to do it. And then it comes out each time everybody waits. No, we're not. No, we're not. No, we're not. No, we're not. That starts to destroy confidence in the system and the institutions as well.
Well, it not only destroys confidence, but we have two problems that nobody's really talking about. As a result of regulations, bond dealers are less willing to take on the risk on the other side of these large trades. So the intermediation system that lubricates the markets and makes it function has shrunk in size. So there are less dealer inventories. And that's important, John, when people are reaching for risk and all of a sudden, let's say that paradigm shifts that everybody expects. And all of a sudden, everybody shifts from one side of the boat to the next. They start doing that at all at once. They're expecting that they're going to be in a liquid position. And we've talked over the last 12 months here, how a lot of these large ETFs and bond funds are basically sitting on illiquid bonds. In fact, the SEC is talking about making some of these funds disclose bonds that they could not dispose of after 7 days. And that is a real risk here with these bond ETFs and bond funds. They're really sitting on a powder keg, large positions, especially with duration risk of illiquid assets. I mean, it's okay if you're in a normal market environment. It's not okay if some kind of crisis emerges and all of a sudden everybody wants to reverse their position. You get these huge sell-offs. And a good example of that is what we saw in 2013 when Bernanke went on Capitol Hill in May of that year and announced that the Fed was going to gradually begin ending its quantitative easing program. We called it the taper tantrum. But basically, the yield on a 30-year bond doubled from almost 1.6 to 3%. And there were huge, huge losses. Well, there's greater risk of that today because the market has become less liquid in the bond market with fewer players. And investors, as a result of reaching for yield, are going out further on the risk curve, longer dated maturities, which could really harm and lose a lot of money if interest rates do something that the market isn't expected. So this risk taking has run ahead of what we would warrant as fundamentals. I mean, once again, the markets aren't moving on fundamentals. They're moving on money flows. And so central bank policy is putting these central banks in a catch-22 situation that governments and central banks had hoped to avoid given the last financial crisis. But, you know, how else can they not stop it? I mean, you lower yields to negative or zero where they are right now, that's what's going to happen. It encourages the very risk-taking that you're seeing take place right now.
So basically what we're saying here then is that the markets and the economies of the world are actually divorced from the fundamentals. They seem to be operating on low liquidity and low interest rates, but not the economic staples that we've seen before.
Well, exactly. And I mean, as many people have talked about, I mean, take everything that you would learn in an economic textbook or financial textbook, and they're diverging from the reality that we've seen today. And it's really leaving policymakers with three outcomes. Number one, the one they hope, which they haven't got, is we get liftoff in the economy. In other words, they can hold back. They could start raising rates, normalize policy. We haven't seen it. We haven't seen 3% and 4% economic growth. So we've been cruising along at 2, and now we're cruising along at 1 and still decelerating. The second one is one that people hope is, well, we could just keep doing this and we'll just kind of muddle along. The economy won't be, it's kind of like the Goldilocks scenario, not too hot, not too cold. And they're hoping that, well, they can just get by until eventually we work our way out of it. Or the third one is disappointment. And the market realizes that, hey, they can't do this, and it creates greater financial instability. So as we often talk on this program here, the market is made up of three factors. One are the fundamentals. One are the technicals. What do the charts say? And the other one is geopolitical and politics. And it's a world that we're seeing today of greater divergences, especially that world that we want of seeking certainty. We live in a world that has greater uncertainty. And I think this is not only perplexed fund managers. You're seeing underperformance. A lot of fund managers, hedge fund managers, got killed this year shorting the interest rate market, thinking that when interest rates got so low, especially after Brexit earlier in the summer, that you can make a lot of money shorting yields, and they went actually even lower. So it's been a very difficult market to navigate because of so much uncertainty.
And what we're going to see, Jim, is I don't think that uncertainty is going to change at any time in the near future. And there's still this talk about raising interest rates. They're dabbling with that, at least as a concept. But to use an aeronautical analogy, the economy is slowing to stalling speed, and doing so would throw more drag out there and ensure that you're going to stall, you know? So, I mean, Jeffrey Gundlach and others have been warning that things are really approaching a critical stage here, which means that Chair Janet Yellen doesn't really have a lot of wiggle room.
Yeah, I mean, the problem is the Global and Domestic Economic Surprise Index, which is what this means. It comes from Citigroup. And what they do is they take what people are forecasting, what analysts are forecasting, what economists are forecasting. And then what happens is the actual reports come in, and they either surprise on the downside or surprise on the upside. When they surprise on the upside, it's viewed favorably for the market, and the market responds. The problem is the surprise index is approaching a peak. And usually that is a leading indicator, John. Once again, what we're looking for right now are advanced notice of what's going to happen to these LEIs. And when you start seeing this surprise index start to peak and roll over, that's telling you that further weakness is ahead of us. And so what we're seeing right now in the U.S. is a weakening business cycle. We're seeing lower corporate earnings. We're seeing the U.S., and why that's important, really, right now, the U.S. is the global growth engine, and it's in danger to the rest of the world, because I believe if we head into another downturn, unlike, let's say, 2007 and 2009, where the crisis originated here in our mortgage market and real estate in the U.S., the likely candidates for the next crisis are going to be outside the United States. They're going to be in Europe, China, and Japan.
You know, we're hearing, though, a lot of prominent advisors are telling their clients that they should get out of the dollar and put their money into foreign assets. But, Jim, if there are crises overseas, it would seem to put that at risk as well.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, because I really believe that's where you're going to see the next crisis. It's going to be in Europe, China, Japan. It's going to be one of those three in emerging markets. We'll throw that in there, because what we're seeing, as we've been talking about here on the program the last couple months, is we're seeing an approaching peak in U.S. global PMIs. And the risk globally of a U.S. slowdown is, number one, the dollar gets stronger. Number two, that weakens U.S. profits even further. We just had the sixth negative decline in corporate profits. We can see that even more. That could end up lowering interest rates and maybe even lower oil prices, and it could start a chain reaction. So we could see a deflationary wave that sets in motion a reflationary response. So the deflation comes first, and then governments, especially politicians, when things begin to get bad, it usually takes some kind of crisis, John, to get politicians to do anything. And what would happen is we could see a deflationary move first, and then what would happen would be a reflationary response to the crisis in helicopter drops, which is what you're starting to hear more of. The problem is, you know, everybody's trying to forecast, and I don't care if you're listening to this program, you're watching the cable channels, you're reading a newsletter, folks, nobody can predict with any degree of accuracy what's going to happen 1 year from now, 3 years, or 5 years from now. And that's why I think you have to play defense here, because, I mean, look how many times the scenarios have changed, two or three times throughout the year, every single year since the economic recovery began following the financial crisis. And that's why I think investors have to be defensive here. I'm trying to think of, it was Vince Lombardi that said the best defense wins championships. And I mean, you really saw that in this year's Super Bowl with the Broncos. I mean, they just basically stopped Cam Newton at North Carolina. I mean, he couldn't get anywhere. They just shut him down. And that's what you have to learn how to do as an investor, is to play defense, because, you know, when you're trying to forecast going out, in an economy and global system that is going through a transitional phase and with the possibility of another downturn ahead of us. John, I just think it's too difficult. And that's why I think in this kind of market environment, you play defense.
Yeah, it's interesting, Jim, because the investors haven't been doing that. That always reminds me of my friend's comment when I finally said, well, you realize where you've got your money, you're losing money, you're losing buying power. And he said, yes, but I can sleep at night. So, and I said, now let me see if I understand this right. You're losing money, but you can sleep at night. But if you were to invest it and risk it, you wouldn't sleep at night. Like I said, I don't quite understand that. And that's what we've seen because so many of them, Jim, you and I both know this. They've been sitting on the sideline in cash or bond funds and gold. And ever since the crisis started back 2007, 2008, this has not played out well. I mean, gold dropped for what? 3.5 years running. Bond yields fell. Cash, well, you know, there is a slight inflation, but it went nowhere at a time when the market per se went up 200%. And so there was no way doing that to recoup your losses from the financial crisis, but they slept better at night, I guess. So I guess the real question though is, I mean, in the whole idea from a military perspective, or like you were talking about Vince Lombardi, the best defense is a good offense. So if you're going to be offensively defensive in this type of situation, how do you play this when you realize that next year we might be down into a recession?
You know, one of the things that we're doing, John, is we are positioning a good portion in short-term bonds. You know, we wait for the opportunity when credit spreads widen, as they did last fall in the beginning of this year when we had a crisis, because we'll have something else that we're going to worry about here in the next 6 months. Who knows where it's going to come from or what it's going to be, but I can tell you something else will surface and it'll scare the markets. Credit spreads will widen. And, you know, if you have short-term bonds, you can take advantage of that. We have been building cash recently because we think we're going to get a buying opportunity. We do have some gold because I think gold is a good currency hedge. And we also have some high dividend, high quality blue chip stocks with strong dividend track records. And that's at least, John, we're getting a return, but it also gives us that flexibility to react to any kind of market environment. And the problem is too many times investors try to do one thing. They'll put their money all in bonds, or they'll put their money in especially bond funds where you have tremendous duration risk right now, or they'll put their money all in gold, or they'll put all their money in cash. And that's the worst thing you can do is place a bet in a single asset class, because how many times have we seen this market diverge, change, and do things you don't expect? So you don't want to be all in gold, because look how people have lost money, but I do believe you should have some gold. You don't want to be in ETFs or bond funds with long duration risk, and especially a lot of these ETFs and bond funds that are sitting on illiquid assets they couldn't dispose. And there's a basic liquidity risk. And I don't think you should be in, you know, I don't like index funds because, you know, all you're going to do is if the market goes down 10%, well, you'll go down 10% when the market drops. So you simply don't know how central banks and what governments are going to do with faced with another crisis. I mean, it's probably safe to say they'll have some kind of stimulus program and the central banks will monetize it, but you don't know when. You don't know if it's going to take a crisis to get political gridlock unlocked and get them to do something. And I'll tell you, John, you know, we follow a lot of smart people. I'm just not smart enough to predict the future at any great length into the future. So you want to be hedged. You want to be defensive. You don't want to be in one asset class. And that's why I think you really need to be on defense, because it's better suited to take advantage when opportunity knocks. If you have a short-term bond, it comes due, and all of a sudden you get a widening of credit spreads, which usually happens in a financial crisis, as we saw happen in the last, let's say, the fourth quarter of last year or the first quarter of this year, you can take advantage of it. If you have a stock market correction, as we did at the beginning of the year, you've got cash. You can go in and buy dividend-paying stocks, higher quality at lower prices and higher yields. But you can't be passive in this kind of environment, or even worse, procrastinate and stick your head in the sand and just hope that things will get better. Because that's what the administration and the Fed is doing. They're basically saying, well, we just hope things will eventually get better. We won't do anything and we just hope they improve. Well, as we've seen, We now are on a glide path that is decelerating in the U.S. economy. It's not getting better. Economic growth is decelerating, and the markets are becoming more risky.
Let me see if I can put this all together. We're going to play defense here, and some of the defensive roles are, if you wish to still make money in this kind of an environment, number one, don't put all your assets in one class. That seems to be a theme which keeps being recurred anywhere, you know, diversify. Two, avoid liquidity risk and duration risk in both bond funds and ETFs. Three, you should probably build some kind of reserves in cash or gold or possibly dividend paying stocks. And as you're being defensive, you have to do so prudently. I think something else too, Jim, is you don't want to marry the vein. You know, people, remember we used to talk about that. People get into one area and no matter what happens, they keep coming back to that one theme. You have to understand what's happening and then take whatever actions are required to deal with the situation.
You're listening to the Financial Sense News Hour at financialsense.com. To speak to Jim Poplava or his financial planning team, call us toll-free at 888-486-3939. That's 888-486-3939. We'd be glad to help you plan your customized investment portfolio.
In case you didn't know it, the Financial Sense News Hour is more than just our weekend show. We also have a weekday program featuring key economic experts, which is only available to our premium members. Here's part of one of the interviews from this last week.
Joining us on the show today is Urban Carmel. He is a writer at the popular Fat Pitch blog. And Urban, the U.S. is the world's largest economy, and there's a saying that if the U.S. sneezes, the world catches a cold. Given the immense amount of economic data that I know you track regularly and that you update on your blog on a monthly basis at Fat Pitch, how healthy is the U.S. economy as you see it?
Well, I think it's important to recognize that the U.S. economy is driven primarily by consumption. So that is true both because, you know, round about 70% of GDP is based on consumption, the rest being government expenditures and investment primarily, and also because 90% of employment is based in services, and services comprise a significant portion of consumption. So when we measure consumption in a variety of different ways, whether we look at personal consumption figures that come out of GDP or we look at retail sales, we see the trend is still higher. So real retail sales are reaching new all-time highs. They are growing at a decent, healthy rate. Same with personal consumption. So, you know, when those things start to change, when they start to flatten out, well, then we'll have an idea that perhaps, you know, the U.S. consumer is getting tapped out. But for the time being, at least, consumption is going higher. One thing that I think is noteworthy and I think is a little underappreciated is that in prior cycles, the U.S. consumer has taken on a lot of debt relative to disposable income or their net worth, right? So they've geared up into a cycle high. And that has been further exacerbated by rates that have been rising. So their debt servicing has also gone up. And of course, the prior cycle ended because consumers were too highly levered, and particularly to housing. And of course, the current recovery has been criticized for being quite slow. And one of the main reasons why it is slow is because consumers have been deleveraging. So what's, I think, noteworthy now is that leverage is very low, like a 35-year low for consumers. And that bodes well for persistence of consumption going forward, because if past this prologue, then consumers will continue to spend, and they will at some point start to take on more debt to further their consumption. And we are in that case, if that is in fact the way this is going to go again, we're not at a late stage of the cycle. So consumers should be expected to continue to consume at a pretty healthy rate going forward as well.
Welcome back to the second part of The Big Picture. Well, I mentioned, if you recall, in the last segment, and it's obvious to most of the world, in the last two decades, I'll stretch it out to two decades, we've had a continuous series of crises. We had the tech bubble bursting, 9-1-1, the housing crisis, there actually was a subprime mortgage tangled up with the housing market, the Arab winter, a lot of terrorist activities, and resuming of the war on terror, ongoing things. What we're going to do in this segment, however, is examine another real crisis that our political candidates are not discussing. And I want to see if they do this, Jim, in the upcoming debates that are coming up. And that is the United States pension crisis. So let's jump into that one.
It's not just the United States, John. It's something that the world is facing, especially in the developed world and even countries like China and Japan. The problem is nobody's talking about a population that is aging, the demographics globally. Now, believe it or not, the U.S. has some of the better demographics when it comes to aging versus Europe, China, or Japan. But the problem that we've seen in pensions, I mean, if we go back to the 80s and 90s, when you could get double-digit returns in the 80s in bonds, I don't care if you were buying Ginnie Mae's, government treasuries, or corporates, you got great returns. And then, of course, the stock market was going up for two decades. So it wasn't a problem then. Number one, the population wasn't as old, or there wasn't as many people entering into retirement as we see today with the boomers. I mean, there's 10,000 boomers entering into retirement on a daily basis in the U.S. But here's the problem for a lot of pension funds. We saw the bursting of the tech bubble. Then in response to that, we saw, for example, the Greenspan Fed bring down interest rates to 1%. And the other thing that we saw, you know, if you take the stock market itself, the stock market as represented by the S&P virtually went nowhere from the year 2000 to 2013. It wasn't until April of 2013 that the stock market finally exceeded the previous highs reached in September 2007 or March of the year 2000. So this major move as a result of the bursting of the tech bubble, you saw a lot of companies get rid of their defined benefit pension plans, and they're still continuing to do that. And what happened as a result, and this has been a long-term trend, is you've seen a shift. Retirement used to be all about retirement income. You worked for a company, you got a defined benefit pension plan, you got X amount of your salary when you retired. It was all about income. And it still is with state and municipal and federal government employees. Very few corporations in the private sector have defined benefit plans. But when they shifted from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans, they shifted the risk from focusing and the emphasis on retirement income to retirement assets. And all became, and we talk about this in lifetime income, it all became everything about a number. What's your number when you retire? You need to have X amount of dollars when you retire. And that's really a false premise to base a retirement on in this kind of uncertain environment. It really needs to be focused on your retirement income, not your retirement assets. And as I mentioned, it's not just the fact that we've shifted the risk to investors, shifted the focus from retirement income to an asset number, but also those assets don't produce the same returns. In the year 2000, $1 million would have got you $80,000 of annual income in a very safe investment. Fast forward to 2016, $1 million only gets you $10,000 to $15,000 of income. Now, that is a major drop in income. And that's, once again, it emphasizes why the shift from retirement income to an asset number is a very dangerous precedent. And it's why so many retirement plans are running awry, because all of a sudden somebody gets into their retirement. You know, what if you retired in the year 2007 and went through the financial crisis and were drawing down your assets? Or you retired in the year 2000 and saw the stock market go down 45% or your tech stocks go down 70%. What did that do to your retirement? And so the market returns, John, just aren't where they were supposed to be. And the emphasis is really in the wrong direction. And this is something that Nobel laureate Robert Merton from Harvard wrote a major article in the Harvard Business Review called The Crisis in Retirement Planning. He was talking about not just the low interest rate environment and low return environment that exists today, but he talked about this major shift on predictable retirement income to focusing on your rate of return each year or the asset number, which is really a misguided approach to planning for retirement.
You know, and to, I hate to say make matters worse, you know, it's always interesting when we describe a benefit as being negative, but life expectancy is going up and we are finding you have more and more baby boomers, especially aging people heading into retirement. Men are moving their life expectancy. I don't have the exact figures here, but well into their 80s, women late 80s, early 90s. And so this makes other demands in retirement and they're competing against the economic situation in which we find ourselves right now. And that's why we're calling this a retirement crisis, as per Robert Merton. What does this really mean? Now, let's flesh this one out.
Well, I mean, if you take a look at the average boomer, they're not experiencing the normal retirement that many of them thought they were going to realize when they got to retirement age. So you're seeing a lot of them continue to work and delay retirement, building up Social Security credits and trying to save more. Another one that we're seeing is a lot of people retire, but then take on a part-time job. You know, some of them become consultants, or maybe it's in a completely different field. You're seeing a major downsize. We're seeing, especially here in California, everything in California is expensive. You're seeing this migration movement in retirement where individuals are leaving high-cost states like New York, New Jersey, places like California, and they're moving to places that are less expensive to live, Arizona, Nevada, Texas, and places that don't have the big social costs, don't have the big tax rates. Housing is cheaper, medical is cheaper. So you're seeing downsizing and transmigration. In some cases, later on, some individuals have had to move in with their children. And in other cases, John, you're seeing tragically, they die impoverished. So we're already seeing this shift in boomer retirement.
It would seem, too, that this is a crisis which is really affecting almost exclusively the private sector, because if you're in the public sector, you still have a defined benefit plan system going. Now, how long that's going to last, we don't know, but there is this dichotomy.
Well, that's the one crisis that we're going to be talking about here that nobody is talking about is the coming crisis to government and state and federal pension plans and Social Security. Basically, you used to go to work for the government in the early days. You made less money, but, you know, it was a secure job and you could be guaranteed that when you retired, you'd have a nice pension. But today, government jobs in many cases are paying more than the private sector. And there is nothing that compares to what government employees are getting in terms of their pensions. And we'll get into this when we get into California, because some of these pensions that a lot of government employees are getting, to duplicate that in the private sector, in other words, to get a guaranteed monthly income, you would have to have X amount of dollars, give it to an insurance company and buy yourself an immediate annuity. It would take anywhere from $2.6 to almost $3.5 million to buy the same pension that a lot of government, state, and city employees are getting in their pension plans in the private sector. And this was according to a study recently just put out by Fidelity. So the issue that we're really dealing here is we have a major funding crisis. We saw this in Detroit. We saw this in several bankrupt cities in California. And there was a report that just came out recently on underfunding pension shortfalls. Right at the top of the list is New Jersey, Illinois. Illinois is going to be a major issue here. Connecticut, Alaska, Kentucky, Massachusetts, Hawaii, Maryland, Rhode Island, Vermont, South Carolina, Kansas, West Virginia, Colorado, Montana, California, Texas, and Maine. And a lot of these states, John, have underfunded. And when you take a look at, there's only out of this study of 50 states, two states that have a surplus, South Dakota and Wisconsin. And the total shortfall as of 2015 to the unfunded liabilities of state pension funds currently is $1 trillion. And they're saying that it's only going to be made up by placing a higher tax on private sector workers to pay for these pensions. And it was one reason, John, that here in my own state of California, they raised the income taxes in 2010 to make up for an underfunded pension plan. They came back 2 years later, raised taxes dramatically in 2012, and it was all for an unfunded pension liability. So U.S. government and state governments, John, are paving the way for opening up the pension system because they need to get more private sector workers into the system to pay for these pensions because there is going to be a tax revolt. I mean, there's only a certain amount that you can raise taxes on working people. You can't just do it on rich people that pay the bulk of the taxes in this country. So there's going to be a tax revolt. So they're trying to figure out a way around that in a clever way to bring more money into the system. It's no different than when they started Social Security, when you had, 30 workers for everyone retired. Today you have about 3. So what states are figuring out, they can't raise taxes without a taxpayer revolt. The way around that is to get more workers coming into the system, paying in. They won't get the same benefits of current retirees that work for government, but that's what they're moving towards. The government is easing the way for the states to create their own retirement system for the private sector to get more workers paying into the system to fund what is really becoming a multi-trillion dollar underfunding crisis for state, city, and municipal workers.
Are they already moving in that direction, or do you find them there, or is that just something that we can anticipate?
No, I mean, the Labor Department just issued a ruling on financial advisors like ourselves and anybody in the financial industry, making us fiduciaries when it comes to retirement plans, everything from a retirement 401k to IRA plans. And the problem is 1/3 of Americans between age 65 and 74 have savings in a retirement account. So the Labor Department is working on rules to expand the flexibility and make it easier for states to get into the pension business because states are hemorrhaging when it comes to pensions. And we'll talk about this shortly when we get to California. So states need more workers to contribute into the pension system because it is underfunded. It's same problem that we have in Social Security, where one time you had 30 workers, today we have 3 workers. So the reality is, and here's the real issue, because when has government been able to do anything efficiently? I don't care if it's Social Security or Medicare. And, you know, the cost of the government administering small pension plans, it would just be astronomical. And that's where the reality comes in. But once again, it's sort of a little ruse to bring more workers into the system to prop the system that everybody agrees is unsustainable. The problem is you've got a lot of vested interests that control governments that refuse to budge on this. And so what will happen is you'll end up with some kind of crisis.
I've always thought that if the United States is the Titanic, California is the bow. And of course, some California cities are already having problems, not just with bankruptcy, but with their pension plans involved with it. So what's going on in California?
Well, this really began a couple of years ago when they raised income taxes to try to bridge the gap of the funding crisis for California pensions. And Governor Brown signed something called SB 1234. And what this will do is eventually require that all businesses in California, private businesses with 5 or more employees that do not already offer a retirement plan, will be forced. And I want to put the word forced. This won't be discretionary. This will be forced to enroll their workers in a new type of savings plan, somewhat based on IRAs. Now, it needs to be passed by the California legislature. And basically, the state has established what they call the California Secure Choice Retirement Savings Investment Board. And they've been meeting since 2013, and they're putting forth various proposals that will go into legislation. It will establish managed accounts that will be invested in U.S. Treasuries investments in the program. So this is basically another form of financial repression because they will not be invested in things like stocks that could grow, it would require the board, now listen to this, to establish an initial automatic contribution rate between 2 and 5% of a salary. So imagine, I don't know, you work for a construction company, they don't have a pension plan. All of a sudden this goes into effect. Your employer, who does not have a pension, if there are five or more employees, he would have to start taking anywhere from 2 to 5% of your salary. It would also allow the board to implement automatic, listen to this, automatic escalation of those contribution rates up to 10% of your salary. So imagine this board, if they're not getting enough money from private workers to fund the system, they can just automatically escalate that automatically to 10%. And it's a whole bunch of provisions. So this is not something that is optional. This is mandatorily, as it's currently drafted. SB 1234 requires all employers within California with five or more employees, they will have to participate in the California Secure Choice Retirement Program. If an employee does not select a contribution amount, 3% of salary will be contributed and taken out of their paycheck. The board, it says, has the authority to change the contribution from 2% of salary to 5% and automatic escalations of 8% of salary with no more than an escalation of 1% in a single year. So let's say they're taking 5% out of your paycheck. They want to increase it. They can do it in 1% increments. And once again, this money is going to go into treasuries. If this bill is enacted, the California Secure Retirement Act would go into effect January 1, 2017. And one of the reasons is they passed a bill back in 1999, Governor Gray Davis. It was called SB 400. And what it did is lowered the retirement age for state workers, highway patrol, police, prison guards to age 55 and 50, allowing as much as 90% of their peak earnings for as long as they live. And the projections were supposed to be solvent. Unfortunately, today, it is becoming insolvent. In 2016, an example, California will spend $5.4 billion on retirement pensions. That is 30 times more than what the state paid in the year 2000. And the state has warned of a funding crisis. And there are many individuals that have said, and experts are telling California, you can't do this. This is unsustainable. Unfortunately, CalPERS board is made up of all union members, and the state has raised payments by $18 billion in retirement in just the last decade. And here's where the problem lies in, John. It's not just for state workers. It's also for private sector. CalPERS is projected when they passed SB 400. Now, remember, they passed that in 1999 when we were going through the tech bubble and the stock market was going up 15% a year. In fact, there were projections made that they wouldn't even have to fund for retirement. The stock market would do it for them. Then they also made other projections because a couple actuaries said, hey, what if these returns don't materialize? They said it would be catastrophic if those returns dropped in half to 4%. Well, let me tell you, last year, CalPERS did not earn 4%. They only earned 0.6%. The gap between what California needs to fund its pensions and where it has now in assets accumulated is a $300 billion gap. And this goes back to the change in retirement planning today. We've shifted the emphasis from planning for retirement income to assets, and those assets don't buy the same amount of income. And it's the same issue, John, that we're going to be facing with Social Security in the years ahead, is that people are living longer, so they're drawing on Social Security. It's one of the reasons they reduce Social Security benefits for women indirectly. When they put together that budget deal last year to save the disability fund, they got rid of two provisions that favor women who in 85% of the cases are the surviving beneficiaries to Social Security. So the problem that we're dealing with in this kind of retirement market and what's creating the crisis is, number one, longevity. People are living longer. Number two, low returns in the market, and number three, underfunding. And this is a crisis, John. You are going to hear more and more. And unfortunately, because of so many vested interests, nothing is going to be done about it until it's too late.
Yeah, it's interesting because it's one thing for you and me to outline all of this as where we stand. It's another thing for the politicians to take ownership of that. I remember way back when George W. Bush at the State of the Union message said Social Security is going to be in trouble and everybody booed him. And yet we knew it was a fact. Now, either they didn't know it, which means the people we're electing are stupid, or they're acting on the basis of political. And to be honest with you, having listened to some of the questions from Congress people during hearings with Janet Yellen, I'm beginning to think some of them are stupid. Maybe, Jim, what it is, contempt of Congress should become a virtue. What do you think?
You know, it's unfortunate. Politicians, and the sad thing about it, in this election, you have some politicians promising even more generous benefits when we simply don't have the money. And the media, which it's almost become an arm of propaganda for the government, they're more like stenographers. They're not questioning, well, wait a minute, you're going to increase this benefit. Where are you going to get the money? How are you going to pay for it? And then talk about the issues we just talked about here. How are you going to make this all work? Nobody's talking about this. And it's unfortunate. That's just the way the system works. Politicians be what they are. They like to get reelected. When you're trying to get reelected, you go to the voters and tell them all kinds of nice things, hand out candy and lollipops, and tell them all these wonderful things that people want to hear. And unfortunately, it's not the truth.
So what we're saying here, just so people understand, this is a crisis which, A, the politicians aren't dealing with, B, it's going to hit us before the end of this decade, and C, we're talking about pension plans here because many of these pension plans, which everybody thinks that they're having secure, I can think of family members who are involved in this, they think it's all good and holding on, those are unsustainable. And talk about the wailing and gnashing of teeth that's going to come them. And that's separate from anything that's going on in Social Security. So I think when you're making retirement planning, like we talk about on lifetime income, you need to factor all these ideas in because this will affect your retirement plans. Well, I don't know if you heard it or not, Jim, but Janet Yellen decided not to raise interest rates again. That sort of was on the back pages, I'm sure.
You're kidding.
Yeah, probably.
That's the first I've ever heard of that.
So now we have a December surprise coming. Will she or won't she? And we're going to speculate on that. Anything else that we should be watching now that we've depressed everybody thoroughly?
What's coming up? We should see some earnings warnings if they're going to be out because the third quarter is coming to an end. So we've got third quarter earnings coming out in the month of October. And then we start, John, a whole slew of economic reports. We'll be getting third quarter GDP numbers. You know, as we do each month, we'll have the unemployment rate, we'll have the jobs. So we got a lot of information, and plus we're getting closer to the election. So a lot of stuff that's going to be moving markets here. The Fed's on pause to December. I don't think they're going to go if these numbers continue to weaken as they're doing so now, which is amazing that this isn't getting picked up more by the press in this election. But that's why I think you're seeing some of this populist movement, because people are feeling what's happening underneath in the economy. But in the meantime, those are the things we'll be looking at in the month ahead. We'll be watching those economic numbers closely, corporate earnings, and of course, which way this election is going to turn. And John, I think the first debate, which is next Monday, it's estimated that over 100 million people will be watching that debate, the most widely watched debate in U.S. history. That's going to be interesting. In the meantime, well, we're out of time as usual. On behalf of John Loeffler and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. We hope you have a pleasant weekend.
You can subscribe to Financial Sense News Hour in the iTunes and BlackBerry podcast libraries, or at feeds.feedburner.com/FSM. Find more information about our guests at www.financialsense.com/newshour. Friend us at www.facebook.com/financialsenseonline. For our on-the-go listeners, you can access Financial Sense on your mobile device at m.financialsense.com. The Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of James Poplava and do not take into account listeners' suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies profiled on or advertising with Financial Sense, or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.